Want more stories in your life without adding to your TBR? That's where Audible comes in. I use it for the original novellas, the Plus catalog like Deanna Reborn's Veronica Speedwell series, and those audiobook sales that you can beat. Right now, Audible has a special offer for new and returning members. Click the link in the show notes to see what deal you'll get and start listening today. Welcome to the What You Read Next podcast. In this podcast, your host, Lori Amin, will interview published authors to chat about their work, journey to getting published, and their book recommendations. If you share a passion for books and always looking for your next read, then join us. Welcome to the What You Read Next podcast. Today, we have a fun interview with Rachel Winters. Rachel wrote What We'd Like to Meet, which is one of my favorite novels of 2019. This book is a homage to rom-coms and which is adorable. In this interview, we talk about rom-coms, Rachel's writing process, as well as a round of book recommendations. Now, let's get to the show. Hi, Rachel. Welcome to What You Read Next podcast.
Thank you. It's so lovely to be on here.
So happy to have you here. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so I'm an editor. I work and live in London, in the UK, and now I have written a book.
I know, I love this book. It's actually one of my favorite books of the year, so I'm so excited to talk about it. So what inspired you to become a writer?
So when I was younger, I always wanted to be a writer. I used to write all the time, but I'm an editor of science fiction and fantasy books, so it was always fantasy that I was reading, or horror. And then I did creative writing as an undergraduate degree, and I had my confidence knocked, and I ended up not writing for years afterwards. I know. And then I was able to write again when working at my current job. We do a lot of creative development, and as part of that, I developed this idea. And an editor just said, why don't you write? And it was the encouragement that I needed. I know, and I just started writing it, and I really loved it. I loved rom-coms. Maybe it was something in the fact that it was a very different genre to the one that I work in, which is I work for Gallant, which is the oldest sci-fi and fantasy imprint in the UK, and the biggest and the best. I'm not biased. And I think it was just the encouragement that I needed and the right genre. And I just really, really, really loved writing it. It was so different from the books that I work on, and yet completely in tune with what I love to write and what I love to read and what I love to watch. So I guess it was a next logical step.
I love it. I love the fact that this book was so reflective of, if you're a fan of the genre of rom-coms, it was like in a homage for it. It was like all the greatest rom-coms just put together and just providing a place for you to just smile. Like, that's what I felt when I was reading the book. I was just smiling. I was like, oh, I want to watch this movie.
That would be great.
Yeah. So I got a question. How much research did you conduct, to get all the different meet cutes going right?
I think I've been researching my entire life without realizing it. It was very arduous. I had to watch a lot of rom-coms again. And I wanted to make sure that I was watching everyone that are out there. So I was doing a lot of research into what were the best rom-coms. And it turns out I had watched them all many times. There weren't really many that came up that I hadn't seen. I'm trying to think of one. Mainly, it was what the kind of films that I just used to watch over and over again. So, When Harry Met Sally, The Holidays, my Christmas film, I watch it every year. I read a lot as well, a lot. But funnily enough, it was mainly, I guess it shows in the book because it's all about film rom-coms rather than book rom-coms. But my research was mainly film-based, which I think probably does come across quite strongly in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the fact that you not only research them and you watch them, but you actually put them in different categories, like the road trip rom-com, the meat, the spilling the orange juice rom-com. Like, there were like different things that were like where you see different tropes in different rom-coms and multiple of them, and then you just kind of like you realize like, oh, I can recreate this experience again. That was really cool.
Thank you. Yeah, I really, really enjoyed putting them together like that, and you start to see the patterns. And I think we're all quite savvy as viewers now, and I think we know the cliches and the tropes that come along with rom-coms. But when they're done really well, you just love them anyway, and it's about the journey more than the destination, I think, with the rom-com. And I really wanted to play into that and pay respect. It's a love letter, really. It's a love letter to rom-coms. I didn't want to sort of tease or make fun in any way, because that the whole point is that they love, well, Evie, the main character, absolutely adores rom-coms, even if the man that she's doing a battle of wills with doesn't.
Yeah, I love the fact there's like the naysayer who's like, I don't believe rom-coms, and Evie trying so hard to be like, no, this actually works, and I'm gonna make it work. And then her girlfriend, you know, the gems, like helping her out, just basically supporting her in the process at the same time, you know, being the voice of reason. I think it was just like a really great setting. I love the setting of like Evie being working for an agent long term and then realizing that she wants to ride, but she had this bad critique, and then still like the rom-coms open up this writing process.
Yeah. I think my friends have, when they've read Evie, they say at first they thought that she might be based on me because it's first person as well, which I think they get, but mainly I think they, as they read, they realized it was very much my sense of humor, but Evie's quite different to me. But that journey is one that I'm intrigued with when I'm watching films, rom-coms or otherwise, or reading books. And it's kind of, even though she's in her late 20s, I wanted to do a kind of coming of age, which is where she's going through this kind of transition. And I really relate to that kind of story, and I really hope that everybody else does as well, where you are at a certain point in your life and you've gone so far down your career and you're questioning whether or not it's the right one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just questioning and then realizing that you can make changes. I think she found her voice in the end. I saw that process of like, you know, just finding her voice and speaking up and finding her worth, where she was, you know, feeling stuck in a job that was feel like that end, and then realizing like there's another world out there for her and there's possibilities and she can go back to things that she loves.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really glad that you saw that in that, because that's definitely, it was just really important for me to not just have the romance, but also to have Evie's arc and her journey from beginning to end and have her grow, hopefully, by the end.
Yeah, she did grow. She had some interesting meet cutes. She had some interesting love story, but she did grow in the end. I think I love that journey. I think that was by far my favorite part of the book. Yes, there's romance, but I think it was just more of like this love letter to rom-coms that allow you to find yourself worth at the end.
Oh, I'm so glad that you saw that.
Yeah. So I love the role of Annette and Ben in the story. It was great. Annette, like, who's that? But she was, like, so spunky. I love her as Tinkerbell and the Spice Girl in Mashup, which is, I think it's hilarious, but I think it's so millennial to have, you know, a mashup of classic with the Spice Girls. So I got a question. How difficult was it to write a child into the story?
Annette was huge fun to write. Actually, I think probably of all of the characters, she came the most natural to me. I don't know what that says. I don't have a child. her role in it was just so I guess clear when I was writing that her dad is very, he appears, Ben appears to be quite standoffish, and he's quite sort of stiff and also a bit shy. And then his daughter is the auntie, the complete opposite of that, where she's like the, almost like the communicator between her and between Evie and her dad. I was actually born quite deaf, about 75% deaf, and it turned out to be very easily fixable for me, which is very lucky. But no one really realised that was the case until I was about 6 or 7. So I spent the first 6 or 7 years of my life in this kind of semi state of not being able to hear very well. So I think that probably also helped when I was writing about how they communicate and how they sort of get around her communication and actually have this really very beautiful, hopefully beautiful relationship that I really, really enjoyed writing about her and her dad, Ben. But yeah, I felt like I related to Annette, although she was far more sort of sparky and very precocious and just like a very, very, very enjoyable character to write.
Mm-hmm. I love how she interfered with the meet cues. So I was like, oh my god, this is so adorable. She was like a spark. Like, she just brought a breath of fresh air. And you know, when you were struggling with the meet cues, like Annette will bring in her own point of view and her own way of doing it. It just brought a new fresh of, like, you know, of ideas and just a spark of inspiration.
Oh yeah, she was a very good sort of character for doing that kind of thing, and she was just that. Every now and then I just think, Annette's not gonna let this slide. If she's gonna be in the scene, she's gonna have to interfere in some way, but in a really, really well-meaning way. Mm-hmm. But she was that kind of, like you say, she was that little spark between Evie and Ben, and getting incredibly involved, and she is what brings them together as gradual friends, really.
Yeah, I like the fact that it was like, it felt like enemies to lovers at the beginning, and then they just became friends, and then they became together at the end. It was a perfect meet cute, just perfect. But I think it was just like the fact that Ben was so standoffish, and I know Ben's story, like, he was dealing with grief and he was dealing with some major changes.
Yeah.
So he was not open for love. But Annette was like interfering. She's like, yeah, we're gonna make this happen.
she knew her dad more than he knew himself.
Yeah, that's so true. So let's talk about your writing. You work in publishing. So how do you feel your experience in publishing informed your writing?
I think that it gave me, it was especially with, we do obviously do it with, with being an editor, we do a lot of edits. And I think it gave me a really good grounding that I didn't have before. So when I was writing myself when I was younger, in structure and story development and character development and what readers are looking for in terms of what their expectations are. And I think it just, I didn't realize before I was an editor how much I loved the actual building blocks of story writing, like the practicalities, and if this thing happens, then something else has to happen further down the line, and cause and effect, and all of that. I really, really love the kind of technicalities of putting a story together and building a story, and helping writers do that themselves, and to do it myself and my own story was just really wonderful, just a hugely enjoyable experience. And I think it really did help, I think, just all of that grounding first with helping other people as much as possible, which is why in the book, even though I was told that technically being an agent in film and TV, you don't really do much editing with your clients. So I had to have Evie choose to edit her client's scripts, so because she enjoyed it so much, which was like a part of my own love of my own job that was built there into Evie's character.
I love it. I love the fact, I think it brought a new set of inspiring things. I think for Evie to edit just gave her another experience under her belt about her writing. Even though she was not writing her own things, she still was experiencing that process, that it was beyond just moving around papers or, trying to fix Monty and, and whatever crisis he was going through. Like, it just brought in, like, well, this maybe, it just reminded me of the reason why she was still in this job. Like, it's, there are a lot of parts that she didn't like about the job, but there's a few things that kept her going.
Yeah.
Because it kept her connected.
Yeah, especially when you're writing a character that's been in the same largely thankless job, thanks to her manager, Monty, mm-hmm. For 7 years, you have to give very good reasons for why she might stay there, which is where she is at the start of the book. But I think we've all worked for a Monty, haven't we?
Yes, we all have.
At some point in our lives, it's like a rite of passage.
Yeah, it's either your first job or a few jobs on the line. Yeah. I have worked for a boss who's just like that, and you're like, why am I still here? And
why am I still here?
Yeah, and you question, and so there must be a reason why you're still there.
Yes, yeah, and there usually always is a reason that you're convincing yourself to stay put, and it's never the Monty. I might have been exercising a few demons when I wrote his character, which again was very enjoyable.
Yeah, how about Nub, Ezra? Like, did you have any characters in mind or people in mind when you were writing him? As being, you know. I would say he was interesting.
Sorry, it just went out.
He was interesting.
Did anyone inspire me to write him? Did anyone inspire me to write him? I think that he was probably pieces of a lot of observations that I've made about certain kinds of men. not all men, obviously, but I think he's definitely not one person. I think he's just a very particular kind of person, which is this very privileged, very self-assured, but ultimately riddled with anxieties, which explain why some of his actions are the way that they are, and what his motivations are. But ultimately, he is mostly ego. I felt like he was that man, that person that you excuse, and you try and find reasons for why they are the way that they are.
Yes.
If you might fancy them. But he ultimately he is his ego. He does have depths. I think that I hope that comes out as it goes on. He isn't just the ego, but he was also, funnily enough, a lot of fun to write.
Yeah, I can imagine he was fun to write because he's like the ultimate, you know, kind of like egocentric, self-centered, you know, same time with like completely naysayer of like, you know, the me cues and non-cons.
Yeah.
And yet he signed off to you. And so you're like, it doesn't make sense. And you just basically how do you come about to this process? So it's like entitled, like, it should come easy to me. So he seems like an interesting character to write.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you follow that line or do you see where the story leads you?
So I wrote the kind of very, it was an outline from beginning to end, so I knew exactly how it was going to end. And my outline went more or less from meet cute to meet cute. So it was quite a good way to build up the blocks of the story. But it was quite brief. It was probably about maybe like 3,000 words, I think, of beginning, middle, end. And then when I started to write it, the first 100 pages or so were a lot easier to write than the rest. As soon as you get to a certain point and it's like you're tipping a bit off a writing cliff where you've built in all of the opening and the introductions to the characters, and then you have to have all of these emotional payoffs that like hit one after another. And at that point, I decided to outline it probably from the middle to the end, literally bullet point by bullet point, including dialogue. And I probably wrote about, 30,000 words of bullet points. And then went back and then filled it all out, which was, I mean, if you could write every book like that, you'd probably do it quite quickly, because as soon as I started to fill out the bullet points, it was so much easier than writing into the void, which is how I see it when I'm just writing, when I'm starting a book, you're writing on that blank page. Whereas when I did the bullet points, it was like having this plan. It was like an A to B plan or an A to Z plan, even, because it was right to the end. And also then I was edited halfway through. So I was edited at like 100 pages, edited at 200 pages, 300 pages, which was because we were doing it for various reasons, but there were as an editor that ended up having that left, and then I got a new editor. So it was all a bit different, like a bit of a different process, I think, than what you might expect, where you might get the whole book edited in one go. So it was an interesting way of doing it, because once you've edited and got all the feedback on the first 100 pages, that guides what you're writing for the next bit, as opposed to writing the whole thing all together, which was really useful in choosing what to write next and what next scene was necessary. But I overwrote by about 40,000 words in the end.
Oh my gosh.
I just cut 40,000 words down, and it is definitely better for having done that. The editors were amazing that I worked with.
That's amazing. Yeah, I can imagine. I like the process of, you know, having the bullet points and then build the story from there. Yeah. I think that seems like a more, especially when you're dealing with so much research, it organizes the story better than just seeing where the story leads you, and you're like, let me backtrack that and change it around. So I like that idea of just doing the bullet points and then build the story from there.
Yeah, and although I say that, and I'm going into writing book two, which is not a sequel, it's another standalone rom-com, and I keep thinking, oh, if I could just bullet point, but I really do think that those first 100 pages or so for me are really important, because you're finding the voice of the character and finding the voice of the friends. So all the friends came out in the prologue in their messages. And as soon as you've done that, then you've got four very distinctive personalities there that are going to inform all the rest of the book. So it's almost hard to plan before you've found the voices of those characters. And as soon as you do that, then that's going to have a huge knock-on effect as you go forward as to what role they all play in the main characters' lives. And so I think that probably you find your way, but I find my way with at least the first 100 pages, and then I think I'll be able to plan again properly after that. But I'll do the same thing again when I do beginning, middle, end, because I think you should, this is the advice that I give to my authors as an editor, I think you should always know where you're going.
Yeah, you should know where you're going. At least you should know what the ending looks like, so then, you know, yeah, there might be some twists and turns, but at the end you should know where, what the purpose of the story is going to look like at the end.
Yeah, I think so. And I think with a rom-com, I guess one of the easy things is that you should know who your character ends up with. And then the fun is just working out how. So you've almost already got the ending. It's like if you're writing a murder mystery, and you should know who the murderer was and why, even if you don't quite know how you're going to get there. Like those are the things that's the point that you're making your way towards. So like the very end scene in Would Like to Meet, didn't come to me until probably quite a few months into writing, and when it did, it was a proper like a eureka moment where I just knew that was the right ending. And as you know, it's because it looks like it's the opening again. It's like a repeat of the opening. It's like a framing effect.
Yeah, it felt like that. It felt like, you know, felt like a foreshadow. I was like, oh, and the ending was like, oh, it just makes sense. It all came together. Like, it was a nice little circle. Like, you get to the beginning, you get a foreshadowing of, like, what it may look like. And then you see the story, and you see all the different meet cues, the friendships, the different things that happen. And then at the end, it's just like, it all came together. It's like a little nice little ball.
Thank you. It felt very, very nice and satisfying tying it up. I was just, I wrote that scene probably before I'd even finished the entire book, I think. And it changed a little bit, but it was one of the scenes that more or less remained exactly the same as the first time that I wrote it. Which every other scene I go over it and over it and over it until I'm happy with it. Whereas that one, I think I just wrote it and was like, yep, done, drop mic.
Yeah, that was a perfect scene. That was like the perfect me-cute out of all the me-cutes that we just struggle. And they were like cringe-worthy, and the ones that were like really cool and really funny. This was like the most like just perfect. It was like, oh, this is how it works.
Oh, thank you. It's really hard as well, because you especially when it's almost like you've written that ending 10 times already. Because of the meet cutes as well. Yeah. So it actually needs to be better than all of those other ones combined, and all the other ones that, well, I mean, spoiler, they don't go quite as planned. They don't go exactly as they go in the movies in any way. And this one had to be unique, and it had to work, and it had to be doubly satisfying because it was the last one and the final one. So it was fun thinking about it. And I had a different one planned, and then I thought, what am I doing? This is absolutely not what the character would want. If this has to be the perfect meet cute for this particular character, not the perfect meet cute that's like the biggest showdown that I could possibly do at the end of the book. It has to be perfect for her. So that's what it became. It became that one, without giving away a spoiler.
I love it. Yeah, it was a perfect meet cute. So thank you so much for putting the nice little bow tie in the great story.
Thank you.
Now let's go to a round of book recommendations. This is an opportunity for you to share with our audience what they should read next. So what is your favorite genre?
So I obviously love rom-coms. That is a given. Adore them. But I guess it's fantasy. Or I could cheat and say YA, which can be both fantasy and romance. Let's say YA.
Okay, I like it. So who's your favorite author?
So my favorite author is not for any YA, but Robin Hobb. Robin Hobb's my favorite author.
Awesome.
Robin Hobb and Neil Gaiman.
Oh, perfect. It's falls within your genre. So what are your top three favorite books of all time?
So my favorite book of all time is, and the other two won't be in order, but this one is in order. So this is number one. It's American Gods by Neil Gaiman, which I read when I was 18 and just hit home in a way that no other book before it had hit home. And then to cheat, another one would be the Liveship Traders trilogy by Robin Hobb. So the three books is one story. And then the final one would be It's Not Me, It's You by Barry McFarlane, which is a really, really lovely rom-com and also stars a character from Manchester who's called Rachel. But that's just just because I'm called Rachel and I'm from Manchester. But it's just such a wonderful, brilliant rom-com, and Barry's such an incredible writer. And she's one of my all-time favorite romance rom-com authors as well.
I love it. I'm going to pick that one up next. So thank you for the recommendation.
Yeah, she's just so, so good. Such a brilliant. And she does a lot of Northern characters too, which is so nice to kind of see in there in any kind of book. And she does them so well. Like the humor is just so particular that she's just my hero.
That's amazing. So what has been a book that you read this year that you love?
So I was thinking about books at these earlier actually, and Red, White and Royal Blue by Casey McQuiston. I've read it and I've listened to the audio afterwards, and both experiences are amazing, and everyone has to read it and then listen to the audio, because it's just the biggest treat that you will ever learn. It was just so good. Shall I say what it's about? Do you know what it's about already?
Yeah, I read it. I loved it. It's the Prince of Wales and the President of Sun fall in love. And we have a female president, which in our current political climate, it's a breath of fresh air. So it's a great book. I actually absolutely adore it.
Oh, I'm so glad that you love it as well. It made me happy cry most of the way through. And then I think I also just cried because it's such a beautiful representation of what this world could be and what it absolutely is at the moment. And I just really, really loved it. And the audio reader just does such an incredible job of both characters. And it's just a really, really, really brilliant production. And also not one to probably listen to on public transport because it gets a bit steamy.
Yes, this is a steamy book. This is not PG. This is like PG-13
new adult.
New adult.
Yes.
You're 18, so it's a steamy book.
It is, but so well written. Oh, she does such a brilliant job. She's such a pristine writer.
It was so good. That was like one of my favorite books. I think I requested it early on in January. And we were like, it's not ready yet. And I'm like, I need to read this. And then when I read it, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I actually have a couple of copies in my house. For some reason, I ended up buying one and then I ended up receiving another one. And I was like, I don't know. So I really love this book. Now I'm going to just get it as an audio.
Yes, it's
a great experience.
Yeah, it took me a few moments to settle into the audio, and then as soon as you do, he just does such a really wonderful, rich job of the characters that you forget as you're listening to it that it's one man doing the two voices, because you kind of fancy both of them. But it's a really great production. Would recommend, and cannot wait for whatever she writes next. And also, the film rights have been sold as well, I believe. So I will be lining up at the cinema to watch that.
Yes, me too. Me too. That will be amazing. Awesome. So tell us where we can find you online.
So I'm on Twitter at Frosty Cheeks. which I'm now regretting. That's a handle that I was a nickname when I was younger. And Instagram as Frosty Cheeks 1, because for some reason someone's already Frosty Cheeks on Instagram.
Oh no.
I know, but you'll see that I usually tweet about my wonderful authors at Galant, as well as probably my flatmate's dog, and a bit about Would Like to Meet. And then mainly Instagram is on travel photos. So I'm in New York at the moment and Brooklyn while I do this research for book 2. So there'll probably be a disgusting amount of photos of coffees and things like that while I'm writing.
That's exciting. Well, thank you, Rachel, for being the show.
Thank you so much, Laura. This has been really lovely.
Thank you, Rachel, for a great interview. For a list of books mentioned in this podcast, please visit whatreadnextblog.com. We'll be back to speak with the Mormon's Book Recommendation Show. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you have a great day.
Are you an author, publisher, or book-related business looking to reach passionate readers? What to Read Next podcast is a perfect place to connect with an engaged audience of romance and mystery lovers who are always on the hunt for their next great read. Now, we're offering sponsorship opportunities. Whether you're launching a new book, promoting an upcoming release, showcasing a bookish product or services, we can help you get the word out. Let's work together to bring your books or businesses to readers who are ready to discover something new. Please visit whatreadnextblog.com/sponsorships to learn more or reach out to chat about the perfect sponsorship or package for you. Thank you much for listening. Your next great reader is waiting for you.